The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Earlier this month, Oregon became the 15th state plus Washington, D.C. to join what's known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Under this agreement, participating states pledge to deliver all of their electoral votes, all of the electoral college votes to the winner of the national popular vote. If enough states join, maybe it could spell the end of the Electoral College as we know it. But will it work? And what will this accomplish? And why are some people working so hard to dump the Electoral College? After all, it's been picking our presidents for so long, and it's been working pretty good, or has it? We're talking about the Electoral College today on The Source. If you've got a question or a comment, call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined this hour with Ian Smith, a professor of political science at St. Mary's University. Ian, welcome to The Source.
Thanks.
And also with us is Sanford Levinson, a professor of government and chair of law at the University of Texas Law School at UT Austin. And Professor Levinson, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Ian Smith, can you kind of summarize, first of all, what is the Electoral College?
Great. So the Electoral College is, we always joke about it not being an actual college. The Electoral College is, most fundamentally, it's an electoral system. This is how we elect our president. And so in many ways, it's changed a lot over time. But most fundamentally, it's a way of counting votes right now. So this is how the states elect the president of the United States. So we added up, 538 different electors, one representing each senator, one representing each House seat that a state has, and three for the District of Columbia. So, basically, this is a group of people who vote, cast ballots, and then send these ballots, on to Congress. They vote at the state level. We count it up. It's something different from time to time, from what originally was intended to as a means of indirect election of the office as opposed to direct election. And I think that's one of the big distinctions we have.
Sanford Levinson, is this what the Founding Fathers intended?
It depends what you mean by this. I think that Ian is absolutely correct that it was designed as a system of indirect election in which electors were actually supposed to be local notables who would engage in genuine choice. That notion of the Electoral College collapsed really by the early 19th century, in as much as electors, even if some of them might be notable, were no longer expected to engage in genuine choice of their own. They were expected to mirror the preferences of the electorate in most states, not all states. In the modern world, if an elector dares to threaten to engage in any independent choice, then he or she will immediately be denounced as a rogue. And so, that aspect of the Electoral College today has literally nothing to do with what was envisioned in 1787, where the framers, rightly or wrongly, the framers were desperately trying to stave off a party system, and they failed completely. By 1800, we were on the verge of civil war because of the Electoral College. So it certainly has changed in some important respects, but not in other respects.
So was the Electoral College designed, or did it eventually try to evolve, or the logic behind justification of the Electoral College became that it was a would act as a circuit breaker, somehow protecting the nation from a very popular tyrant. And that became like a talking point, right, Professor Levinson?
Yeah, I would say that notion collapsed in the early 19th century, that we verged on civil war in 1801 because a lot of Federalists really did view Thomas Jefferson as satanic. And it took, I think, 36 votes before the House basically acquiesced to accepting him as president. And then in 1828, a person regarded by many of his opponents as a sheer demagogue, that is Andrew Jackson, was elected. And so that notion, I mean, I like your term, circuit breaker, that the term isn't used, but the concept is certainly central to Federalist 68, in which Hamilton spells out the way the Electoral College is supposed to protect us against the demagogue. And if you read Federalist 68 today, you're reading basically a fantasy.
And we can also see that if a demagogue is able to capture the public and get the popular vote, then they essentially also capture the Electoral College simultaneously, Professor Ian Smith.
Yes, we don't see the Electoral College doing that well at blocking individuals from office. I think what we've seen it can become more is instead of blocking this faction of party, I think it can block factions of or controls regional factions and blocks a little bit. At this point, I mean, that original purpose is hollowed out. After the 1820s, we started essentially each state holds a referendum on how the state's going to vote in the Electoral College. So, you know, if someone can capture the vote in enough of the states, they're going to win. We do see it maybe prevent more of large states beating up on small states due to the way that the allocation works, that those small states get that two-vote bonus as well. But much, you know, really that's also factored into the Senate from the Great Compromise on.
Yeah, the Great Compromise. So Alexander Hamilton, people remember him as the founding father who could rap. And he actually wanted to have a president appointed for life. And this was the compromise to figure out a way to keep the rabble from selecting the president, Professor Levinson?
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And
The Constitution was drafted by people who, by and large, treated democracy as a negative term, not as a positive term. It's really only in the 20th century that democracy becomes a positive term. So when Woodrow Wilson says in 1917 that we're going to go to war to make the world safe for democracy, that's a completely different intellectual universe from the one of 1787. They were trying to prevent a system that would exhibit what they viewed as really all of the bad tendencies of democracy. That is, you know, rule by, quote, the people, unquote.
So when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about popular sovereignty and democracy in the United States. Would it be a good thing if we were somehow able to switch over from the Electoral College as we know it now into a new system that's being floated, one that's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact? What is that? What does it look like? Is it gaining traction? If you got a question or a comment, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The election that put Donald Trump in the White House, the final votes were 306 to 232. It's not the people that counted. It was the electoral votes that counted, and that was the margin that brought him over Hillary Clinton, even though he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by more than 2.8 million ballots. That's the way the system is. That's what works. That's how the cow ate the cabbage. But moving forward, people are thinking maybe we should change things. We've had multiple elections in the United States, Al Gore being one of them, who lost the presidency even though he won the popular vote. What would happen to the electoral system? What would happen to the way we politic? Would this be a good thing for the United States if we were somehow able to use the language we already have in the Constitution to make the electoral vote more reflective of the popular vote? If you've got a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Let's go to the phones with Jonathan. And let me get the clicker here. Jonathan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. My comment is about the Electoral College. At the founding of the country, the founding fathers initially meant for the our representative bunch to represent people who were uneducated to represent themselves, because most of people couldn't read or write at the time. And the founding fathers initially meant for it to go away after a period of time and everybody became educated enough.
All right. Jonathan, thank you for that. So Ian Smith, a professor of political science at St. Mary's University, we have had an evolution since the founding of who could vote, including from the very beginning.
Right. I mean, the early era of the U.S., we see, you know, severely restricted electorates, right? Just white male landowners. They had a fear that people who rented property would be beholden to their landlords. And of course, obviously, the racial and ethnic suppression of vote as well. Today, we really, you know, we see that as a very common solution when you look back into the 1780s. France even still maintains a vestige in how they elect their senators are still elected by mayors and such. So we do see, you know, it's an older way of solving this problem. Modern democracies, if you're creating a constitution today, we really just don't see much of that. Maybe an indirectly elected Senate here or there. But by and large, you know, we even go out of the way now when you look at a lot of elections in countries with high illiteracy rates, say in Africa, Southeast Asia, you know, they vote for a picture that represents the party or the candidate. So, you know, modern democracy, we don't really try to do those things as much as was done before.
And so Professor Sanford Levinson with the University of Texas Law School and Austin, can you add to that? You know, why evolve who can vote?
Well, I think Jonathan is right about his comment of, you know, fear of the great unwashed. Where I would disagree with him is whether or not the framers intended that the Electoral College at some point would go away. I don't think there's any evidence of that. And if they had intended it, they could have put in a sunset provision. So after, you know, 25 or 50 years or whatever, we would at least have a chance to return to it. And we never have. There have been literally hundreds of proposed amendments on the Electoral College, and they've never gone anywhere, in part because at different moments you have enough people in either Congress, and all you need is one-third plus one in one of the two houses, or if it were to get out of Congress, all you need is one-quarter plus one of the now 50 states. Sometimes small states will resist any idea at reform because of what Ian said before. Small states may view the Electoral College as a way of protecting themselves against states like Texas. Other times, you have a coalition of so-called of big states and especially battleground states who love the attention they get. The big states like the fact that they have a lot of representation, so that the, you know, the Texas Republican Party, the California Democratic Party, by getting, let's say, 55 or even 60% of the vote, can throw 100% of the votes to their favorite political party. Then you have states like Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania, which love being the center of attention and being pandered to. And frankly, that would go away. So proposals at amendment have been completely unsuccessful up to this moment, even though at various moments you've had widespread support. Since 1944, every single poll of the Gallup organization has shown a majority of the public receptive to getting rid of the Electoral College. So the reason we have it isn't because the public likes it. It's because those who benefit from the status quo are able to block any changes.
Back to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Join our conversation as we talk about the Electoral College, its history, its performance, and its possible future. Bobby's on the line. Bobby, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. You know, the question that I have is a couple of one and a comment. One is, how do you protect the rural small states from the large states if you do away with Electoral College? Because if you look at a map of the United States and the votes for the 2016 election, for example, the vast majority of county-by-county elections were red, and there were only like 10% of the counties that went Democrat. But because they're in such large metropolitan areas, they got a large vote. For example, if you take California out of the equation, Hillary Clinton actually lost the popular vote by 1 million. So how do you protect everybody else from New York, Chicago, L.A., Atlanta, you know, in those cities that are large metropolitan areas?
Bobby, thank you for that question. So Professor Sanford Levinson from UT Law.
Yeah, you often hear this, and let me answer in a fairly simple and maybe provocative way. The basic argument that John is making is an argument for affirmative action. That is to say, we should be so concerned about protecting minorities who live in Wyoming or Idaho or Vermont, you know, take a blue state, that we should give them extra voting power against the terrible people who live in San Antonio, Austin, L.A., and, you know, just march through the cities that are mentioned. You know, I suspect that if anybody said, you know, John, you're right, there really is a danger that people who live in cities just don't know much about people who live in rural areas and will consistently vote against their interests. So let's give people who live in small states, or for that matter, who live in Deaf Smith County, let's give them an extra vote, maybe even extra two votes, so to make up for the power that people who live in San Antonio and Austin have. I have a hunch that people would rise up and say, that's ridiculous that we believe in one person, one vote. And if we do believe in one person, one vote, then quite frankly, it shouldn't matter where you live. You just add up the votes, and the majority wins, period.
But we do have some skewing of the vote. You know, a person who votes for their senator in Mississippi, that person's vote means more than a person who votes for their senator in New York, because there's a lot fewer of them.
Right. Maybe you should invite both of us back for another program on the Senate. Because let me tell you, I'm not a fan of the U.S. Senate for just this reason.
Okay, but back to the Electoral College.
Right.
270 to win. That's what you got to have. You have 270 votes to win. Seems like simple math, Ian Smith, but I don't think Hillary Clinton passed that class.
Right. I think that's. I think there's a problem with the strategy that you need to use to win. If we look at electoral systems and parties, these things are so deeply intertwined. And part of it is this, you know, parties play the game. You need a strategy that wins the game at hand. I think that's one of the big problems that the Clinton campaign had, was they played a bit more of a national, you know, they played the Electoral College strategy, but they did, there was a lot of talk building into this election of this 50-state strategy. Let's go big, win the popular vote. In fact, you know, we see the Trump campaign narrowly focused itself on the rules. There's one way to win this campaign, and they won it that one way.
It helps also to know your opponent's strategy,
right?
When you're able to hack into their systems and get where they're going to be.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't hurt to have inside information, and like the personal mudslinging contest of it. I mean, a campaign is such a dynamic set of issues.
But you're right that so the Trump campaign focused on we need to crack the blue wall in the mid and that's what they focused on.
Right. And the Clinton campaign neglected this idea of a blue wall as perhaps maybe too dangerous. You know, we talk about and the Electoral College does favor these rural conservative areas across the country. But of course, that didn't stop Barack Obama from winning in 2008 and 2012. So I think there are strategies that both sides can use to win in this. Both parties do have a policy for it. But it is a more complicated process than maybe we think. You win Ohio, win Florida, win it all. You still have to protect your sort of rear flanks of your electoral coalition as well.
So Ohio has 16 electoral votes, just about, yeah. You know, but because it's a swing state, it's a winner-take-all situation. And so, Professor Levinson, how does that weigh into this?
Well, I mean, that all you need to do is come in first. You don't, in fact, need to have majority support in a state. George W. Bush, let's assume for the moment that he got more votes than Al Gore in Florida, which we could argue about that till the cows come home. But let's assume he, in fact, won by 586 votes or whatever it is. Nobody believes he had 50% of the vote, because if you add together the Nader and the Buchanan votes, then Bush has something like 48% or so. But all you need to do is, I say, come in first, and you get all the votes. So that means that, or, you know, take Texas, where Donald Trump did get a clear majority of the vote, but a clear majority, I think, was something like 53%. And with 53%, he gets 100%. There's no good reason to accept the winner-take-all, behavior, except, frankly, that states, or I should say more accurately, I think
it's a partisan process.
That political parties who control states clearly believe it's in their interest to give 100% of the votes to their guy or woman, whatever the actual percentage is. But if you ask ordinary people, look, you know, you have 16 votes to distribute, you have 16 apples to distribute, and you've got, you know, two children or three children who want the apples, what's the fairest way to do it? Generally speaking, people will say, well, you divide it up according to some principle. Either, you know, children get an equal number of apples, or the oldest child will get an extra apple. But you don't immediately say, well, the best way to allocate the 16 votes is to give it to the person who comes in first, even if first means 45%.
But that adds to the intensity of swing states. And if we were to somehow change things with the Electoral College, that might make things a little bit more fair. What would that look like? We're going to continue our conversation about the Electoral College. If you got a question or a comment, a prediction, if there's something bugging you about the Electoral College, call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this quick break.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Do you feel like your voice counts in the presidential election? Do the 38 Texas electors represent your values? Should we change the way that we elect presidents and so that maybe Texas is more proportional as we divvy up our 38 Texas electors and electoral college rather than a winner-take-all? Earlier, we were talking about Ohio, and we said 16 electoral votes. That's actually 18, so I wanted to get that right. If you got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980 as we talk about the electoral college. And so Texas, let's talk about that. Professor Sanford Levinson with UT Austin School of Law. This was not a battleground state, but maybe it could be, and Texas could see lot more attention moving forward, maybe in a 2020 election.
Oh, sure. I think that's undoubtedly true. And you know, it will become a battleground state because the perception is that maybe a Democrat can win. On the other hand, if we didn't have the winner-take-all feature, then we in Texas would actually have seen the presidential candidates during the presidential campaign, which basically we never do, because they would have been trying to run up the vote. You know, whereas there is no incentive for a Republican to visit California, or until maybe next year for a Democrat to visit Texas, or for a Republican to give serious speeches about cities, or you can even argue if you want for Democrats to give really serious speeches about rural areas, because they're viewed as, you know, basically predetermined. But it's certainly true that if some of the perceptions hold up that a Democrat could win Texas, then we're going to see lots of visits. One of the dumbest things that Hillary Clinton did was to pay 25 visits to Florida and zero visits to Wisconsin after the Wisconsin primary. That was just dumb. But it was based on the assumption that Wisconsin was a safe state. You know, Clinton didn't pay that many visits to California either, and Trump, I think, came to Texas maybe once.
And Ian Smith, professor of political science at St. Mary's School of St. Mary's University, how would that change things, you know, if suddenly we got rid of the Electoral College and it's going to be popular vote, folks? How presidents would have to change their strategies completely?
So I think it would definitely open up a lot more states to the game. Republicans would go to, you know, right now Republicans go to California to find a few wealthy base for a fundraiser. Texas, you know, it's all about the fundraisers. Now, you know, if we opened it up and made it more proportional or went to a national popular vote, I think we would definitely see more states get more attention. I think we'd see some states lose it. I think there'd be a little less attention to some of those small, closer states here and there. Maybe New Mexico would lose a little attention. But, you know, states like Texas, you know, we would see more of that. I don't know that, you know, as Professor Levinson said on the urban-rural divide, I still think we would see Democrats come to San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Houston.
Oh, sure.
And then we would see, you know, Republicans go to try to run the vote up in the panhandle and in some of the more conservative suburbs. So, you know, I think it would change the nature of the campaign. I think the hardest part is, you know, how do we get to, you know, how do you jump to that point? How do you make that change? Mm-hmm.
Another thing about elections are it's about winning the election, but you don't want to win at this scorched earth type way of doing things in that you just alienate half the population while you enamor the other half. And is the system we have now, does it lend itself to that? Or if we move to a different system, would it be destructive? I mean, it's all, you got to have something to govern. And you don't want everyone at each other's throats in that process. So What about that effect, Professor Levinson?
There, frankly, I'm not really confident as to how the electoral system itself would affect the kind of polarization we now live in. I can imagine scenarios under which one system or another could be effective. I would be a very strong proponent, and I think this is one of the weaknesses of the fair vote system that you were describing earlier, which continues to be a so-called first-past-the-post system. All you need to do is get more votes than anybody else. It doesn't have to be a majority. I'm much more of a majoritarian, and what I would strongly favor is some kind of ranked choice voting, also called the alternative transferable vote, so that when you showed up at the ballot box, you could indicate your first choice, whoever it is, and then if your first choice is, you know, comes in last, let us say, take the easiest example, then your second choice would get your vote. And you can keep doing that until somebody has majority support. That, it is argued, would tend to reduce at least somewhat the polarization, because one of the consequences of the system we've got, that is first past the post, is that it really does seem to encourage a base-oriented kind of politics and, frankly, a near indifference to even whether you get a majority. The important thing is to get it to get more votes, and that's it. So I do think there are some modifications. Maine has now moved to the use of ranked choice voting. But, you know, frankly, we are not having a truly serious national conversation among political elites. I think programs like this are extraordinarily important in letting people know that there are some people who are thinking about the Electoral College. But if you look at, you know, kind of major pundits or major political leaders, a few of them have said, oh, yeah, we need to get rid of the Electoral College, but they've not spelled out exactly what they would do, whether it would take a constitutional amendment, as some of the things would, some of the changes would. So it's almost a casual toss-off, rather than a truly serious policy proposal.
So according to a report by the Congressional Research Service, there have been 700 different proposals floated in Congress that would reform or repeal the Electoral College. It's enshrined in the Article 2 of the Constitution, also in the 12th Amendment. But despite all of this opposition, it's still alive and kicking. I got an email from Elise. She says, my vote was not reflected in the Electoral College. College's vote for Texas. It discourages me from voting again. I feel like it's a waste of time. If people feel like their vote is would be counted, I bet more people would vote. Is there a correlation between voter turnout and a lower and being lower and when the popular vote is ignored? Ian Smith.
So, Scott, I was actually running some of the numbers on that this morning for coming in. I think, you know, we expect to see that. Voting behavior really is based on a couple of things. How close you think the race is, how important you think the outcome is, how difficult it is to vote. That's where your voter ID laws become an issue. And sort of this patriotic fervor about voting, your sense of civic duty. So, you know, I think one of the big things that the Electoral College does in theory hit at is that likelihood of you casting the vote that changes, right? You're in Florida, that seems higher. You're in, you know, if you're in the 23rd Congressional District out here in San Antonio, you know, it depends on where you are. It's some races are close, some are distant. But I think that there are a couple things going on here. I found some indication of it that maybe the Electoral College doesn't matter. But remember, while the president is the big topic of national voting. People are also voting for governors in some states on presidential years, Senate seats, local congressional elections too. So I think it may depress the out. I think it does have some factor of depressing turnout that your presidential vote doesn't matter. But since we're voting for more than one office, I think that does dilute the effect a little bit.
All right, another caller. This is Kathleen. Kathleen, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering what and how the people of the United States can create an amendment, for example, term limits. I don't think it'll ever happen in Congress or the Senate. So I'm wondering how many people does it take to, and if that has ever happened in our.
Okay, so can the public force some sort of constitutional amendment, Ian Smith, to reform the Electoral College?
So, I mean, we don't have a direct set of methods here. Like we do at some state and local levels. Some countries have those levels. If the public wants to take action in this, there's two routes to do it. One most straightforward route is if you can win over your state legislatures, if you can win over state legislatures in 3/4 of the state, you can actually amend the Constitution without any congressional input. In fact, we don't really see that done. All amendments have originated in Congress and then been ratified by the states. So the other way is really, you know, how do you vote in Congress? You're going to have to get a supermajority in Congress and then get 3/4 of the states along. So, our founders were very, very conservative when it came to protecting. They really wanted us to seek consensus. If you could build that consensus, it could be done, but that's going to be difficult in a very polarized
environment. So it's a very tough lift to do to change the Constitution, particularly with this, but people have a plan to change the popular vote system within the language that exists now in the Constitution. We'll get more into that when we come back from the break. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. What is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact on The Source when we come back? You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There's a proposal called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Under this agreement, participating states pledge to deliver all of their Electoral College votes to the winner of the national popular vote. There have been 15 states that so far have signed on to this. So this is a plan that doesn't require a constitutional amendment because it doesn't get rid of the Constitution, it doesn't get rid of the Electoral College. Supporters believe it brings parity back to the voting process where every vote counts. But will this actually work as it's gaining traction? What would it look like? Ian Smith.
So this idea works within the ability of the states to allocate their electors. So this is essentially an interstate compact that state legislatures are going to pass a law to say that instead of allocating, the current method is to allocate all of our state's electoral votes to whoever won the most votes within the state. Instead, this pact is going to say that the state will allocate the votes to whoever won the national total. So the idea, of course, the big problem is, of making our votes more proportional or not is who goes first. If Texas goes first, then the Democrats have an advantage because California does winner take all. It's vice versa if it went the other way. So the idea is that these states, once we get up to a point where a number of states totaling 270 electoral votes, which is what's required for a majority, sign on to the pact, all of them will pick up that national vote total. And
so it's kind of like a GoFundMe thing where you don't have to pay until they meet the goal.
Right. So this sets up this, it helps with this, what we call a first mover problem, that obviously if, you get, your votes would be meaningless if you did it right away.
So let me go to Sanford Levinson, professor at UT Law. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, I agree with what Ian said. Let me raise two points. One is, a technical lawyer's point. The other isn't. The technical lawyer's point is whether you could actually enforce this through you know, to the courts, so that if California at the last minute decided to renege, presumably the Republicans could go and say, no, you signed this pact. You have to give all of your 56 or 57 votes to the Republican. The question is whether an interstate compact requires congressional assent or not. Some interstate compacts don't. Others do. To put it mildly, this is not a well-worked area of the law. If you believe, as I kind of do, though I frankly haven't thought it through that deeply, that it would require congressional assent for something so important, then, frankly, it's impossible for me to imagine that the Senate would agree to this. That's the lawyer's point. The other point is that there's a huge difference between giving your votes to the person who comes in first in the national poll and giving your votes to a person who actually has majority support. I am very ambivalent at best about the national fair vote proposal, because what it fixates on is 2000 and 2016, where the person who came in second got the majority electoral votes. I tend to fixate at least as much on 1968 and 1992, where in both cases, Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton got to the White House with 43% of the popular vote. I think that is at least as problematic as what happened in 2000. I mean, 2000 was more or less a statistical tie. 2016 is very, very different. But I would want to see a genuine reform, a much more fundamental reform, than a patchwork which might solve the 2000 or 2016 problem, but does nothing to solve the 1968-1992 problem.
So if we do these reforms, we run the risk of just turning the Electoral College into a nut house and having to go to the Congress or some sort of Ruth B. Hayes type compromise to pick a president. And how would that look? I mean, Ian Smith.
Well, I think that's there's a lot of issues that come up around the edge of this too. First of all, we don't have a national popular vote count. The states allocate the votes themselves. So there's no federal election body that would do that. So if we came to a 50-50, you know, let's say we had a 48-48 tie, you know, it could be, you know, a state secretary of state's office could manipulate the total up one way or another. Who do the states vote for? So that creates there's a lot of details that would need to be worked out. If it's within 1%, do we send it to Congress and vote by delegations? Because that's the constitutional rule. Or do you vote by state on the old, you know, or current electoral college system? So I think, I mean, if this, so far this idea is still a little bit of a pie in the sky idea. It's very aspirational. Even though the state legislatures are working on it, now, I mean, there's a narrow chance that there's a set of possibilities where this could happen as Democrats still fear 2016, but maybe Republicans start, you know, looking, you know, worrying about the popular vote, too. So we need to figure a lot of details out.
Yeah, and that's
first.
Scary. Let's go to the phones with Pete. Pete, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, it just has to do with a question about how to deal in this 21st century with the influence of social media. That would certainly impact the popular vote. We saw that happen in the last election. And then also we've got the challenge on the Electoral College side of states making decision about how they're going to allocate those electoral votes. And, of course, we have politics underneath that, and politics are funded by big money. And so how are we going to go forward, you know, between a popular vote that may be impacted by social media and also the influence of money on state legislatures? Or
so more online interference, hacking, people, more bitterness with our elections. Ian Smith, could that be the
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be an issue going forward, no matter what electoral systems we use. As any system in which we've got mass participation in elections, and mass participation in some sort of social media sources. We lack the sort of refereeing that we have in the conventional press, in the conventional campaigns. That opens up a lot of things. I mean, how do you know whether someone is real, your neighbor four doors down, or is actually a Russian agent who's creating this false image? I mean, they've learned how to do this. That's something that we have to deal with no matter what system, whether we elect proportional, whether we were a parliamentary democracy, we'd still have to be concerned about this. And I think that is a problem that we need to solve both at the state. Both at the state and the federal level. Same as you mentioned, money can help too. If you have money, you don't have to be a Russian GRU agent to do this. You could be a wealthy person could buy up large amounts of buy up a lot of social media time and influencers.
So Professor Sanford Levinson, moving forward, it looks like we're going to have the Electoral College. The one we have now, we will have in 2020. What can we do to ensure that it will function the way it's intended?
First of all, going back to the very, very beginning of the hour, it's not going to function the way it was intended, because it was intended to be a much more indirect system. But now, the electors are simply supposed to reflect the voters. I don't have an optimistic answer to your question. I think basically you have to pray. I want to come back for a moment to Ian's last point, because I think it's important. I think that one of the ironies may be that social media and big money play a much, much more important role at the state level than in fact they do at the national level. We have an electorate of, something like 160 million people or so. And it's really, really hard for discrete individuals or for a discrete group to influence millions of people. It is not so hard to focus on a key part of Wisconsin or a key part of Michigan or, for that matter, Texas, as Texas becomes a battleground, and really make an impact. Ian had mentioned earlier voter ID and what some people like me are tempted to call voter suppression. There's much, much greater incentive to try to control the electorate in any way possible, the smaller the electoral unit, so that in Wisconsin, it almost literally made all the difference in the world that you could manipulate, let's say, 30 or 40,000 votes. If we had a national vote, then 30,000 votes aren't nothing. But in an electorate of 140, whatever it is, Ian would know the number, whatever it is, 30,000 votes just tend to get lost in the shuffle. Ian also made another extraordinarily important point, that if the Electoral College doesn't work, because, for example, in 2020 there's a party led by a dissident Republican, and nobody gets a majority electoral vote, then it goes to the House, which votes on a one-state, one-vote.
And then it's anyone's, and then becomes another mess, another program to talk about. I want to thank Professor Sanford Levinson. He's at the University of Texas Law School in Austin, and Ian Smith, Professor of Political Science at St. Mary's University. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams. Direction provided by News Director Dan Katz. Technical assistance provided by Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.